This is the 22nd of May, 2014. Derek Hockaday interviewing Andrew Freeland. Andrew, when really did you come to Oxford first?
I was appointed an SHO on December the 1st, 1968.
As an SHO
in ENT surgery. Right. Having come up from Cornwall on the train, having missed ENT as a student, but in Cornwall I worked as a SHO, a house physician, to a most wonderful person down there who convinced me that ENT was the way forward because you didn't get up at night. Mm-hmm. And anyway, applied for this job, totally unqualified for it. And at the same time, when I eventually got appointed on December the 1st, 1968, Bill Lund started his first day as consultant in the hospital on the same day.
Right.
And a person who later became a great friend, Jack Friedberg from Canada, became a visiting senior registrar. So there were three of us starting on that same day. And Gavin Livingston was still alive.
Right.
And working.
And he was just a remarkable man. He was losing weight all the time, but he would insist on coming to work with pethidine tablets, sitting next door to this useless surgeon of me, and getting me to take a tonsil out, and then when I got it wrong, he took over and took the rest of it out or whatever. So he was a very generous man.
Yes. And where had you trained before
that? Well, I was trained at Guy's.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Ronald Macbeth had retired.
Macbeth retired, I think, in about June 68. But when Gavin died, he came out of retirement to do a locum. Mm-hmm. So at that stage, there was Bernard Coleman, who was appointed in 1964. Mm-hmm. He'd been a senior registrar in Edinburgh and then had been appointed a consultant in Coventry. And then the job came up in Oxford, and Livingston and Macbeth appointed him as a full-time consultant, not allowed to do any private practice,
right.
But to do research. So he came in 64, having had an amazing reputation, actually, in one of the original people to do the operation of stapedectomy,
right.
Done, which he did with a chap called Hal Schutnicht in Boston,
right.
Where they trained. And then he bought the first operating microscope to Edinburgh, and then the second operating microscope came to Oxford. So it was the beginning of microsurgery, really, of the ear.
Right.
And he was very much involved in that.
And would you say he did much research? I mean, did he do animal research material research?
He had a programme going of cats, which I think most... And he was trying to look at the sterility of the operation in cats, but... Looking at all the specimens later, he decided that most of them had got cat flu, which I don't know what that was, but the thing was so infected. He did do some very good early research in the States, which is still actually quoted as, you know, it's still a quoted paper. But anyway, so he was there. Bill Lund had come from the Middlesex,
yes,
where he was also a consultant for a couple of years. And then having been a senior registrar originally in Oxford, he went to the Middlesex consultant, and he was appointed in 68,
yes.
Along when I was a brand new SHO.
I mean, to my mind, there's the feeling that ENT Oxford had an innovative name, that they did or developed new things.
Ronald Macbeth was a remarkable man,
mm-hmm.
and quite a tricky chap. To
yes.
work with, but he was appointed, I think, in 1934, somewhere around there. Didn't go to the war, but was very much involved in things going on in the war and kept a lot of the Radcliffe running. He used to start operating at 5 a.m. and finish at 2 p.m, so everybody could go home to their families and get the blackouts organised.
Gosh.
So he ran the department, and he was single-handed.
Uh-huh.
He came with no beds in the hospital, with an ear syringe in 1934, I think it was. Gavin Livingston joined in 1946, I think, having been a society doctor from St. Thomas's with huge private practice and a large Bristol motor car that used to whiz up and down to Harley Street from Oxford to Harley Street. He still
really?
Kept the practice on for a bit.
Right.
Yes. And he started. And Ron Macbeth had, in the meantime, realised that there was a... he knew Flory quite well. Mm-hmm. And I know the story is always of the policeman and the... I think a brain abscess, as far as I can remember. But he started to work with all the chronic mastoid disease, putting this penicillin powder into the mastoid cavities. So he was highly... Mm-hmm. And there were lots of little stories that I don't know how true they were of Macbeth and Flory and, you know, using this stuff until it ran out and had to be recycled from the urine and all this sort of business.
But it worked as...
But it seemed to be better than the sulfonamides, which was the other alternative at that stage.
Yes,
and that was all written up too. And but he then invented this operation for chronic sinus disease, which was very common in those days, where he did a thing, it was called an osteoplastic flap, where the great big scar went round from ear to ear, the scalp pulled forward, the front wall of the frontal sinus removed, and the whole thing cleaned out right down to brain if it was exposed, and then replaced. And it undoubtedly was quite a major advance on what was a dangerous disease then, you know, pre-antibiotics. People were dying very commonly of sinus disease.
Yes, right.
And there was a lot of osteomyelitis in the skull. And he decided that the way forward was radical excising to get around the osteomyelitis and to put do this flap. So it's always actually known, it still is known as Macbeth's operation in some textbooks.
Mm-hmm.
Although it's been modified and it's hardly needed now with all the modern chemistry that's available. And meanwhile, Gavin Livingstone had got involved with the thalidomide disaster, which not only caused tetraplegia of these children, but many of them were born without ears.
Right, I didn't know that.
And we got a grant, and this is before I knew anything about it, but they got a grant in the Radcliffe from the Lady Hoare Thalidomide Trust.
Mm-hmm.
And nearly all the thalidomide ears were done by Gavin Livingstone in Oxford. And he became Mr. Congenital Ear Abnormality in the country, and extensively lectured. And he became president of all sorts of children's ear foundations and things.
So when you say they were born without ears, is that the outer ear?
The outer ear, the inner ear. The outer ear was missing, so was the... It's all on the branchial development of the ear, but the middle ear was missing.
Right.
The ossicles were often missing, but the inner ear, the cochlea, which develops from neuroectoderm, was there. So there was no sight, the potential for hearing was there, but there was no sound getting in.
You'd think the pinner would be the plastic surgeons, but it wasn't.
Yeah, well, he worked very closely with Eric Pete.
Mm-hmm.
And they did they did all the pinner work, and Eric Pete did the pinner work, and Livingstone did all the
middle ear.
The middle ear, and trying to reconstruct an ear canal, because that was missing.
Yes.
And indeed, when I came in 68, we had a garden in the old ENT department where we used to keep a pump that was... The exercise for the laryngectomy patients was putting tar on the bottom of the pump so it would float that year. But there were always children having tea parties with all their ears bandaged up and no limbs. And I've still got some photographs somewhere of all this.
Fascinating.
And so he got a huge reputation in congenital ear. And even, well, I don't know what happens today, but even when I was retiring, we still were referred a lot of congenital ear abnormalities. There were different ways of doing things now.
Yeah.
So Macbeth made this huge influence on this sort of thing, and he became president of the section of the laryngology at RSM, and Livingstone did the same.
Did they meet in Oxford?
Yes, I don't think they knew each other until they...
Those two, but the section...
Oh, I'm sure they did.
Yes.
We have something called the BACO, what's that stand for? The British Association of... It's a four-yearly mega meeting that we have, international meeting that the Brits put on. I've forgotten actually what it's called. I think it's changed its name. But the very first one was organised by Ronald Macbeth in Oriel.
Very great.
In about 68, I think, was the very first one.
Yes.
And it's progressed since there. So he was very much a national figure.
Yes.
And known in Canada a lot, too, for some reason. Yes. I'm not quite sure why, but he went off there a lot.
So did you apply for Oxford on the advice of this chap in Cornwall, or because you'd heard about the work, or just because...
No, not because I heard about the work. Yes. I just thought that ENT... I wanted to be a paediatric surgeon until I met one who said he was up all night.
Yes.
And I didn't like eyes because...
Right, that's the alternative, I agree. Why not?
Well, I went to, as a student, I remember going at Guy's to watch eye operations, and all you could see was his eye looking at you. And that put me off immediately. I didn't mind blood, but just one eye looking at a drape while somebody was tinkering.
And then once you'd come, you really stayed in Oxford all the way through.
I did a research year in Canada.
Right. Where was that?
In Toronto. Mm-hmm. I worked in the Banting Institute, actually, with all the, Banting and Best, so mm-hmm. close to your heart in College Street.
Yeah. What did you work on?
I was, at that stage, I was doing laryngeal cancer work. It was 1974, when I was out there, 73 to 75, and 1974 was 100 years since Billroth in Vienna had taken the first larynx out.
Oh.
So my boss, Douglas Bryce, out there, said we're going to have the centenary conference in laryngeal cancer work. You're going to do the work, my lad, and I'm going to present all the papers, which is fair enough.
He was quite frank about it.
Absolutely frank. He's a lovely man.
Yeah.
So I was stuck. And they had this wonderful pathologist out there who'd taken an interest in the cancer work. And when he got a larynx, he did these very fine sections all the way through the larynx. Mm. And so there were these big slides, and it was to look at the growth and spread of laryngeal cancer. So that's we were quite heavily involved in actually classifying, you know, these TNM classifications, which you could do from the pathology, often that you couldn't see by naked eye. In other words, a small tumour might have spread somewhere, and that's really what we were doing. So there were about 10 papers that came out of that year and a half, and that's what I did. But I don't quite sure why I got back to Oxford, and then I was very much dealt with all the children with congenital airway problems. That got me up at night a lot before they'd invented this surfactant stuff that stopped the hyaline membrane disease or respiratory distress syndrome, because up to then I was up there quite often sucking out the right main bronchus, which always got blocked up with this gunk.
So
they're
really
babies.
Small babies, right?
Yeah, they're premature babies, the newborn,
in
the neonatal intensive care unit. And then I did a lot of the airway work. In fact, when I was president of the laryngology section, my presidential address was on trauma to the larynx, because in Canada, the farmers used... That, exactly right. Well, in Canada, the farmers did not like snowmobiles going over the fields, compressing the snow, which wrecked the winter wheat.
Right.
So he used to string piano wire across the fields. And the snowmobile, they were almost garrotted, some of them. But that was one of them, apart from the cancer out there, that was the main clinical thing that I was taught about in Canada.
Right.
And when I got back, it was just before they had proper seat belts. There were still the lap belts.
Mm-hmm.
And people were being injured by the dashboard. And because I've done this and written one or two things, a lot of patients, not nationally but regionally, came to Oxford. So we had got quite an experience of laryngeal injuries.
So you went to Canada as a senior registrar?
Yeah, that's right.
And came back as a consultant?
I came back as a senior registrar, and within about two or three months later, Tim Till had retired.
Right.
And for some reason or other, there was a decision made that they didn't need another... I think Nick Dudley was already in post.
Yes.
And they didn't need another thyroid person. And the money... And it may be something to do with Macbeth, although he'd retired by then, and transferred to ENT. So I think I was funded from Tim Till's pot of money as a third ENT consultant, because there was Macbeth and Livingstone. There was Macbeth originally, then Livingstone joined him.
Yes.
And then Coleman came, so there were three. Then Livingstone died, and Lund was appointed, so there were still three. And then Macbeth retired, so we were left with Lund and Coleman.
Yeah.
And I was appointed late 75.
Yes.
And then in late 75, they decided they really needed a third, because the work was building up. And both Lund and Coleman were busy and away quite a lot. And they need a lad on the ground. And I was the devil they knew, I think.
Yeah.
So I was.
Well, they were great, I'm sure you earned every minute of it. But we'd say when you were senior registrar, of the students, clinical students, they would be attached for 1 month, 3 months to ENT?
No, I think they were much less than that. They came, I think we only had them for 2 weeks. It was never, unfortunately, it was never really, until it was realised how common ENT was in general practice, it was never considered terribly important in the core teaching.
Yeah, I know.
And I think there were so many other calls clinically on the medical students that... and I think ENT was also quite difficult to teach because it was very difficult to look down orifices. It was so much easier when cameras came on and endoscopes that you could project images. But actually to watch somebody in an outpatient clinic looking in an ear and saying something or other wasn't terribly impressive to a student.
Yeah, yeah.
But we used to do, I know we had a 2 week course because I used to run that, and we used to try and do it fairly methodically to equip them for what they might expect in general practice, but it wasn't as practically orientated as it could have been.
And was it, when you say you ran it, was that as a consultant?
Yes. That was one of my jobs that was handed on to me, right, Freeland.
Great. But who would then really do the teaching? You personally, or the senior registrar? Or
We had two senior registrars in those days, and they were always very good.
Yes.
So I think I suspect it was the senior registrars who did most.
And now Bill Lund, he had a sort of invention, didn't he?
Bill Lund did his MS on the pharyngeal pouch. And the formation of the pharyngeal pouch. So he did a lot with that. And then he really took over Gavin Livingston's work on congenital ear surgery.
Right.
But Coleman also did that.
Mm-hmm.
And there was always a bit of jealousy between the two. But you've stolen my patient, that sort of thing. But yeah, that's what happened. And then, But I think there were three of us and two senior registrars, two registrars and a couple of SHOs, and actually it was a very close-knit community. And when I first came as an SHO, we were housed where Plastics is now, Kilner Ward.
Down
the main corridor on the right. And we had a little outpatient rooms upstairs, a tiny library. And Macbeth was always upset that we were never a university department.
Right.
And he thought that we ought to be more academic, and so did Coleman. And when Macbeth was chairman of the Medical Staff Council, and I'm not sure quite when that was, there was the maternity unit was being built at the John Radcliffe, and I think that was opened in 72 because my number three son was born there. The other two were in the old Radcliffe. And when they knew they were moving, Macbeth said, he was chairman of the Medical Staff Committee, we will have the maternity block. So ENT moved to the Walton Street site of the Nuffield Maternity Home, as it was then called. And which was absolutely wonderful because we had two operating theatres upstairs. We had that was the second floor. The first floor was three wards, one children and two adults.
Is that remember you had a lot of space?
Huge amount of space. And then down below we had a lovely outpatient facility, and we had an academic unit with a very nice library. And in fact, it was one of the best libraries in the country from old journals going back to when Macbeth was appointed.
Right.
And we all used to contribute a bit of our salary into providing one journal, and it was kept up. And now I think it's all, with what the Cairns Library, I don't know, but with all these electronic journals, it's changed. But we were quite proud of the library.
Yes, they're great. And then when the general surgeons went up the hill, I mean, did you feel bereft of them, or didn't
no,
you have much
we
longer?
Didn't, because we had plastics, neurosurgery, eyes, and ENT, and there was a huge amount of cross referral.
Right.
So we didn't, and I think that they were the natural link somehow, because ENT often used to stray into neurosurgery, and some of the brain abscesses were caused by the nose or the ear. So it was very useful to have them.
Yes.
And I mean, my first exploits with that was with Joe Pennebaker. And as a very junior registrar, he was absolutely brilliant sorting out the odd cock-up.
and teaching you.
Oh, he was a wonderful man.
Yes.
In fact, my very first paper I ever did, he was the main author, but he told me to do it, and he corrected it all, and he got published, and I was very proud of that.
No, I bet you were.
As a very junior doctor, and And then the plastics became more and more important. I gave up doing head and neck cancer surgery and became purely ears after a bit. Mm-hmm. And my main interest has been children's deafness. And we started our cochlear implant program in Oxford, mm-hmm. and one of the first ones in the country. And then I'm still president of the Oxford Deaf Children's Society. Not that I do very much, but,
no, great.
But I still keep a hand in it.
The cochlear implants. Now, what is that? Is that a mechanical bit of apparatus or a biological bit?
No, it's mechanical, mechanico-electrical. What happens is it's for children who are largely, I mean, it's adults as well, but it started really with profoundly deaf children with no hearing, virtually no hearing. And what happens is that a tiny electrode is winkled into the cochlea, mm-hmm. which stimulates the eighth nerve. And since there are 32,000 nerve endings in the cochlea, and one's got a maximum of about 16 to 20 channels, how it works, I have no idea. But somehow
it does.
The
brain is a wonderful thing.
It's very clever. And yes. If you get these things into 9-month-old children now, by the time they're 3, their speech and language development is almost the same as a normal 3-year-old. Having in the past, when I started, being confined to sign language or special education, all that sort of thing.
Yes.
So it is actually, it's been a remarkable advance, but it's nothing to do with the surgeons, it's actually to do with a very clever electronics industry.
Where were they invented? This country, America?
There was a single channel one down in the House Clinic in Los Angeles, probably in about 1982 or something, and then the modern ones were all done in Melbourne,
uh-huh.
in Australia,
mm-hmm.
and that's still the one, well, one of the two models we still use. I mean, it's been upgraded enormously.
Yes.
But
so did the nose ever lead you to the pituitary?
It didn't lead me to the pituitary. It did with Bill Lund. He did
right.
a lot of work. And then Chris Adams took it over.
Yes.
When he found that by sticking a cryoprobe in the side of the nose with reasonable, or with much less trauma than we were causing.
Yes.
We were always very sceptical about that because we reckoned if you're going to freeze something with the huge blood vessels around the outside of the pituitary, how you actually froze the bit of the adenoma or whatever it might be, right at the edge, but anyway.
Would he be seeing it? I mean, this probe, would you,
I think
have
he
a
did,
vision?
I think he did it on X-ray screen.
Right, yes, yes. Uh-huh.
But I never, I did one or two as a junior, as a trainee, but I didn't really do that. But Bill Lund did it,
mm-hmm.
By an external ethmoid approach.
Yes.
Well, he did actually see it very well. But there was an occasional problem with the transverse sinus that went in front of the dura between the two cavernous sinuses on either side. And I don't know why Chris Adams seemed to ignore that, but he seemed to get in there. But we worked very closely with Chris Adams, but he was a powerful man.
Yes.
And a very, very, very good surgeon.
Yes.
And, if I was a patient, I think I'd have been quite happy to have him handling me.
Yes. Then how does private practice interact with all this?
I think private practice was always done over the road in the Ackland.
Mm-hmm.
And originally Bill Lund was a big private man, and Livingston and Macbeth before him, and they all worked at 85 Bamboo Road,
right.
which was a little bit further up the road. And then when 23 Bamboo Road became available, the rents were much cheaper than 85, so I think everybody moved there, and it
yeah.
was such an easy thing. And although I did a bit of private practice, it was so easy being more or less on site all the time. And Joe Smith taught me when I first appointed 75, said, come and do a private clinic with me, and I'll show you how you treat private patients. And the first thing I realised, he'd had students in there teaching them how to behave and how to talk to patients. And I often had students in my private
yeah,
rooms.
Yeah.
I thought, come over the road and you can just see how. I was always very against people calling patients by their Christian name, and I always liked people to look like doctors and shake hands properly and eyeball. And there were silly things, but Joe Smith taught me a lot of that.
Mind you,
slightly old-fashioned medicine.
The first bloke I worked for, Evan Bedford, at the Middlesex, and he taught me that the more important the private patient, the ruder you get. Because you've got to get on top of them.
Well, I don't think I saw anybody very important.
And the nursing, what did you feel about the nursing in Oxford?
Oh, gosh. We knew exactly when I first started who was in charge. And there was Sister Jean Bowie, who ran the wards in ENT absolutely superbly. And there was Sister Montoya, who still lives in Wantage, who's still alive, who ran the theatres.
Uh-huh.
And somehow or other, all the nurses, well, they were different, I think. We had some very, very good, devoted nurses that stayed for years and years and years. And we had some wonderful SENs that looked after the patients by plumping their pillows up, and they were always around and talking to them. And in my opinion, I'm sure a lot of people's opinion, things changed a bit once degree nursing came on and SENs were got rid of.
Yes.
There must have been a matron at the Radcliffe, but I don't ever seem to remember meeting her. Didn't seem to matter very much, because we knew who our matron was
in our ward. The sister, yes.
And they seemed to be permanent structures till they retired.
Yes.
And then when they did retire, we had... Yes, two. One became one of our nurses got upgraded to take over the sister, so it stayed much the same.
Right.
And one of them actually is still a health visitor, I think, in the Abingdon practice. One of the Abingdon practices.
Then the handling of wax in the ears. How does that evolve with the ears? Because at one time you had a sort of wax clinic.
Yeah, we did.
Walk in, yes.
We had a wonderful wax clinic.
Not you personally, but that was started in your time.
Well, I think there was a problem with GPs syringing out ears, that they were bursting eardrums every now and again with a bit of extra pressure.
Yeah. I think nowadays it's all done with hoovers, you know, vacuum cleaners. You sort of oil the ear with grease, which makes it for a couple of days, and then it suck it out under a microscope.
Uh-huh.
But we did have a wax clinic. I can't remember too much about it, but it was run by the nurses.
Right.
And the other clinic we had was a hearing aid clinic, which was absolutely wonderful. These huge old hearing aids, Madresco Medical Research Council electronic hearing aid, it was called, but Madresco was what it was always called. Big boxes of wires. But the registrars, when I was there, used to love doing that clinic because it needed no brain power. They were fabulous people who'd all been through the war. They were all deafened through the war. They all had wonderful stories. And we used to have sweepstakes on the average age. but it was great fun just talking to people.
Yeah,
so nobody, it sounded, oh, God, boring, the hearing aid clinic. But actually, none of us minded doing it because we knew there wasn't going to be major decisions to be made. And great fun talking to the people.
Was there a lot of interference with those hearing aids? I mean, the sort of buzz on the terrible background.
Yes. Nearly all hearing aids spent their time in the top right-hand drawer of the dressing table. I think in those days almost the only reason for wearing a hearing aid is that you could see someone was deaf and therefore you made a little bit more effort to speak to them clearly.
Right.
But as an electronic aid, they were pretty useless.
Oh, right, okay. And what would you do? I mean, how many outpatients a week would you be doing?
Well, I started as a consultant. I had three operating and four outpatient sessions a week.
Yes.
And there was one teaching session. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what the other... I suppose there was an encore. I don't know how it was divided. I mean, I was what they called 9/11ths.
Yes, I know.
No, I was 10/11ths when I started, and I became 9/11ths.
And the 1/11th, was that nothing, or was it university?
That was private practice.
Yes, right. Yes, I understand.
And then we did... Because we weren't a university department, and although we were attached vaguely, we came under the Nuffield Department of Surgery.
Yes.
So that was our university sign, if you like.
And you'd have been an honorary lecturer.
I was an honorary lecturer, yeah.
But honorary and alive.
Very honorary. No, I wasn't terribly good with that sort of thing, but the students had great, you know, we had great fun with them. We always used to, for some reason or other, the ENT course always was just before Tindrick. So they were usually absent practising.
Yes. And, I mean, the number of students, of course, changed a lot.
Yes.
Do you think that altered anything, really?
I don't know. There was much more two or three people around a bedside that you could get to know. I knew their names. That was the... And actually, when you saw them in the corridor 6 months later, you knew their names.
Yes.
And I think that was very nice. Now... Well, when I left, I found it very difficult to sort of know who was who or who hadn't turned up.
No, what I don't know is whether that's a function of one's years or the numbers. I'm sure the numbers were a huge part of it.
It probably was the numbers, but I think there's also a huge increase in the number of teaching staff or potential teaching staff. I mean, if you look down the telephone directory of psychiatrists, I'd have seen so many.
And anaesthetists.
anaesthetists, that's right.
How important are anaesthetists?
Vital. Mm-hmm. No, I worked with one anaesthetist all my career. He retired 2 years younger, a chap called Alan Loach, who I was at Guy's with. Mm-hmm. And the other two lists were done with Dick Fordham and Tony Fisher, who were both, and they stayed with, we worked together all, they, and we enjoyed the sessions. But Robert McIntosh and Ken Boston liked ENT, and the McIntosh laryngoscope, which is still in use today, was designed because Ronald McBeth said, come and have a look at this. He was putting one of those tonsil gags in. They were called, what they called Boyle Davis gags, that's what it was. And he cranked it open, and you could see the larynx.
Right.
And so the blade of the tonsil gag is exactly the same shape as the McIntosh laryngoscope. Because McIntosh had a technician called Salt.
Oh, I remember him, yes.
And he said, Salt, come and have a look at this. Make me one of those. And ever since then, people have intubated using a McIntosh laryngoscope, the blade of which is exactly the same shape as the Boyle Davis gag that's used for every tonsillectomy in the world, almost. And Ken Boston, there were a lot of Boston instruments. I can't quite remember what they were now, but they were things for intubating people and bits of endotracheal tubes and things. And we also worked very closely with John Lloyd,
who
started the pain clinic. But he started the first intensive care unit in Cronshaw Annex.
Did he? Right. Yes.
Do you remember Cronshaw Annex?
I do indeed, yes.
And there was this thing called the Oxford Tracheostomy Tube, which was a right-angled red rubber to which a lot of people were allergic, whatever the red rubber was. But it was some... They were very clever because it was an Oxford tube, because they put a magnet in the opening so that a ventilator would magnetically clip into it. The pipe from the magnet would fit into the tracheostomy tube.
Yeah.
And they were called Oxford tracheostomy tubes. And I think somewhere... There used to be a very good anaesthetic cabinet of old instruments and things. And there are a lot of things like that design of the McIntosh laryngoscope and Salt's contribution to making them. And
did that go up the hill, do you think?
It must be up the hill in the Nuffield Department of Anaesthetics.
Right.
But there, you'll also see those red rubber, right-angled tracheostomy tubes. And I had to, well, as a junior doctor, I did a lot of the tracheostomies for John Lloyd in the... he was the first...
Now, tonsils, I mean, there used to be a lot of tonsillectomies, now there are fewer. What sort of led to that change? Is it right or wrong?
Oh, completely right. I mean, it was just a fashion.
Yeah. Antibiotics, nothing to do with it.
They might have done, I suppose, in that I think now you have to earn a tonsillectomy. You know, a GP has to write from my records, I've had this child or this adult's been in 6 times this year, missed...
school.
A few months of school or a few months of work, whatever it is. And with years, it's not getting better. But I think before, there used to be an awful thing called a tonsil drive, where, and they were done with a guillotine.
Uh-huh.
Beth started this, but you could do 12 children in about sort of an hour, quickly gassed down with ether. And as they were recovering, their tonsils snipped off.
And what stopped the bleeding?
That's a very good question. At least one of them came back each night to be properly tied off. No, it was all pretty brutal. But I never got involved with that. That must have stopped, actually, in about 67 or 68, because I never saw a tonsil drive.
Yes.
Although Macbeth did make us do tonsils under local anaesthetic on a Friday afternoon, which was... you had to be a very stoical patient. You sat up in a chair with a plank behind you so you couldn't put your head back. And you sat in front of them.
The local inside.
Local inside, yes. Yeah.
Gosh. Is there any evidence that the tonsils do you any good in later life? I mean, are you deprived of it?
No, the norm, if you've never, I mean, I've never had my tonsil or adenoids out. By the time I was 11, I had no adenoids. They wither completely.
Right.
By the time you're 20, you don't have tonsils. You only have tonsils if they've been infected, and the scarring from the healing infection leaves your tonsils behind.
Right.
But nobody's quite sure what they are, but it's something to do with IgE production and IgA.
Yes, I know.
And
sort
I think,
of thing.
You know, those things that I didn't learn at medical school.
No, I was just too old for immunology. I never understood it.
Oh, good.
But, and, I mean...
So tonsils are done now, mm-hmm. but I think you have to earn it quite a lot.
And it's actually, just flashing back, Bill Roth, was that the stomach man as well?
Exactly right.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
Good Lord, yes.
Yeah.
And, what was I thinking about? And have you been in the new department up the hill?
I worked there for...
Right.
I retired in 2008 in September, and I think we moved up there in 2006, so I had 2 years up there. But the whole thing was so different because we moved from a completely identifiable unit with our academic department, with a lovely library, a little lab, and all our private offices and things, with outpatients, with ward above, a theatre above, to an amorphous big block, and shared our ward with the plastics and with the eyes, and you could never find your patient and all that sort of thing. So I'm afraid I never got used to it, as long and short of it.
Sure.
Never ever got used to it.
Before you, ENT, moved up the hill, did you have to go up the hill much for
it? Was mainly to the Churchill.
Right.
No, why would it? Oh, but to the respiratory people, to the chest clinic.
Mm-hmm.
And
what would you do
we went up. We did go up the hill for children. What did we go up there? The children's intensive care unit,
yes,
used to ask us to go up there to,
yes,
do tracheostomies and that sort of,
yes,
thing. And I worked a bit with Steve Westerby too at one,
right,
stage.
Well, doing well.
Well, Steve was very keen on an artificial heart,
yes,
called the Jarvik heart.
Yeah.
The Jarvik heart needs electricity. And because I'd been screwing things into the head for implants and things, I did the wiring for it. So,
right,
we used to implant the electronics into the head and then feed a wire through the neck to connect up with the heart, the thing he stuffed inside.
Mm.
So that was my role with that.
Why didn't that succeed in the end, as it were? I know it worked, but it didn't take over cardiology.
No, I think I'm not quite sure, because there were other heart devices.
Mm-hmm.
Because I went out with Steve once or twice to the Brompton Hospital, where we put them in,
mm-hmm,
and worked with the people at the Brompton,
mm-hmm,
and they were developing another one. Now, whether it's one of these things that they were, I think it was designed as a the best use for it was for a cardiomyopathy, as far as I remember. And if you gave the heart a rest for long enough,
mm-hmm,
the cardiomyopathy would sometimes improve.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what it was designed as.
Right.
But then I think they found that there were complications with the machine, and the death rate was a bit high too.
Mm-hmm. And were you going up to London to committees and things?
Yes, I was. I wasn't on the College of Surgeons Council, but I was on. I worked for the RSM quite a lot.
Right.
I was president of
the section,
the ENT, yeah, bit of that.
Right.
And
would that be for 1 year or for more?
That was a year.
Yes.
And
you ran the programme.
I ran the programme. I was a few years before I was secretary of the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And,
Yeah. Do you enjoy that?
I loved it.
Yes.
Loved it. ENT had 420 consultants. I was president in 1997, and I knew everybody. And most of the trainees I knew, because I worked on with the College of Surgeons on the Specialist Advisory Committee for quite a long time. And so I used to go around on the interview panels, interviewing people for senior registrar jobs and things. I also worked for the College of Surgeons in Ireland, as it was called, in Dublin.
That was fun, I think.
And I'm an honorary Irish, whatever I might be, I don't know. So I still go over there to their annual meeting. You should play golf. I don't understand what they're talking about. But they're such a lovely bunch.
And what would you say have been the big changes in ENT over your time?
I think, well, apart from the increase in consultant staff, the big changes has undoubtedly been due to the sophistication of micro-instruments, of electronics, of very sophisticated visual equipment, not only microscopes, but also endoscopes. So it's very, very rare that if you have a sinus problem now, anything is cut open, it's all done keyhole-wise. Mm-hmm. And that became a problem because not everybody has good hand-eye coordination to look at a television screen and operate down here.
Yeah,
and it sorted a lot of people out in our specialty, you know, and people stopped doing that. But the biggest changes in my career have undoubtedly been the microscope, the very fine instruments, usually made in Switzerland or Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And the electronics, mainly to do with the ear.
Mm-hmm. Was there ever any difficulty buying the instruments you wanted?
A lot, you know, it's a funding thing.
Yeah, what would happen? You'd indent for something?
Yes, you did. Yes. I mean, what in the end happened? One of the theatre girls worked out that actually, for me personally, doing a certain number of operations, I was only using four or five instruments. What was the point of having a great tray of these instruments were never used?
Mm-hmm.
And she managed to work out what each of us was using most of the time. And so we had doubles of those kept in very good condition and a few extras.
Mm-hmm.
But it was quite a good system because it saved, you know, it saved money.
Yeah,
and it instruments didn't get damaged because they were always being damaged. Originally, in the old Radcliffe, the instruments were looked after by the theatre porter, or the theatre technician we had then.
Mm-hmm.
They're beautifully looked after, but then when we moved to the autoclave system, they were put in a box, trundled down the corridor, and these very fine ends of these little micro scissors and things were getting damaged.
Yeah.
And so there was an awful lot of damage going on. So there wasn't a point, and there's a huge problem in getting funding for the electronics, because a cochlear implant, originally, was costing about 30,000 per patient. So you had to be very careful and work out who was really going to benefit.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a bit of a lottery.
And is that the administrators you'd have to convince, or your fellow surgeons?
No, it was the administrators, right, or the funding people. But then what happened, NICE interfered.
Yes.
And it's become such a cost-effective thing, much more cost-effective than a hip or a knee, that money has come from other budgets. Making.
Who was on the panel? Do you remember? I mean, administrators or
doctors? There were always two GPs.
Right.
And then there were sort of finance people and administrators, right, but there was always a couple of GPs, but I don't think there was anybody. There might have been a public health. In fact, I think it was one of the public health doctors, somebody like Muir Gray, but it wasn't Muir Gray. Right. Can't think who it was now.
But then no, as it were, consultant physicians, no consultant surgeons.
I don't remember that.
No, that's interesting, isn't it?
So you had to write a pretty good...
Yes.
You had to be able to defend what you're trying to do, what the evidence was.
Yes.
But eventually NICE have taken it on now, and since I've left, it's become, you can, you know, you have to get the criteria right, but it's not difficult.
In your time, do you think the relationship between consultants and administrators has changed?
Well, yes, I do. I mean, down at the Radcliffe, we always knew who the house governor was called. I like that.
Yeah.
And if there was a problem, you know, if somebody was unhappy, one could always go and approach him, particularly David Wilson. I've forgotten the chap before now, but they were very good.
Yes. John Barrow?
Yes, I do remember him, John Barrow. Yeah.
Yes.
But I think, I mean, the awful thing is now that I was up at the John Radcliffe for 2 years and I never ever met the chief executive, Michael, whatever his name is.
I never met one. No. Up there, it's...
And the only time I met him was at a charity concert in Dorchester Abbey for the Children's Hospital.
Right, yeah.
When he was sitting in front and I sort of said hello and he was not interested and I just retired.
Yeah.
But in the, you know, they used to give little sort of parties if you retired in the...
Yeah.
Not that mattered at all, but there was no communication from the what they call medical director now and or the chief executive. So I think things have deteriorated.
Yes.
And although all those... different, what do they call them, there was the regional health authority, the district health authority, the area health authority, although they all got sort of amalgamated, it's still one amorphous bunch that I never knew quite who they were. Yes.
Do you go out into the periphery? You did a Whitnick.
I did Wantage and Tame.
Yes.
And I got to know the GPs very well out there, and I loved that. There was...
And within the region, would you go to Milton Keynes or...
No, I didn't. What's happened now is that Stoke Mandeville, High Wycombe, and I think Wexham Park hospitals have all lost their inpatient beds, and they're all being done at the John Radcliffe. All the emergency work's coming to John Radcliffe.
Really?
So the consultants there are purely doing day case work at their base hospital, coming to do the inpatient work here.
Right.
So there's so many people knocking around.
Right.
The emergency work has built up. Most of it's not, you know, it's nosebleeds and other things, but nevertheless, it's keeping people on their toes, which has really meant, and because the junior staff now have such a short period of training, they're not, the apprentice scheme has gone a bit.
Yeah.
The consultants are in a lot more. You know, if you're, although you're only on call now, one in, I don't know, eight or something, I'm surprised they can remember when they are on call. When you are on call, you're often in.
Yes. And there's enough theatre space for all these characters to run around and about.
I would doubt it. I think people have all lost lists, you know, and you know, it's not. I had a very, very good innings, I must say. I thoroughly enjoyed myself, but I could see the writing on the wall when we left our old apartment that we were all so used to, where we were autonomous.
Yes.
Where if we wanted a bit of help from the nearest surgeons, somebody would pop over. If we wanted a bit of plastics, or they wanted us, we could just pop over because. There was a big link with the cleft palates, for instance, in plastic with us, because most cleft palate children are also deaf with this thing called glue ear, because part of the tensile palatal muscle opens the eustachian tube. And if the eustachian tube doesn't get opened, you get this fluid in the ear. So we had quite a link with them. And it was so easy if they were doing a cleft palate and said, could somebody just nip over and have a look at these ears while the patient's asleep? And it was that sort of cooperation that was so easy. And also Jericho became an important, the Jericho Cafe, the sort of meeting place.
Was that in the building?
No, that was outside, yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's a pub down there called the Radcliffe Arms. If one of the administrators wanted to know where you were, oh, I think they're in the Radcliffe somewhere. But the junior staff they loved that side of it. Actually, being in town, being near the you know, the university buildings and everything else. If you needed to go to look up something in the Radcliffe Science Lab, you could do that in your lunch hour.
Yes,
very easily.
Yes. Did anybody introduce protocols? You know, care by working down a scheme. You know, yes, no sort of scheme.
No,
I mean, nobody tried to impose that on you, or in any sense.
No. Well, I think it happens now, probably,
right.
But it must happen now.
Yes.
And in fact, it's happened, I think, with tonsils. You know, you can't see a tonsil unless it's been referred from a GP, and you can't see it unless the GP says it's had n number of attacks per year, and then when you get it in, you know. So I think there are these protocols, but
you kept clear.
I kept clear of all that.
worked him down.
And I was never terribly good on evidence-based medicine. I always thought I knew best. And there's all this bit about, you know, experience, isn't there? Yes. You've sort of seen it before, so you think, but actually trying to make it scientific, and all this Cochrane collaboration, I could never cope with that.
No, I couldn't really. What haven't I asked you about that I should have?
I don't know. I mean, it's difficult to predict the future, isn't it, of medicine? But I do worry about the future a bit, and I think with funding, I can see a hospital like the, you know, we've got in Oxford is a major teaching hospital, it's a major university hospital, it's a major district hospital. And I think trying to cope with the district and the regional referrals and teach and be university is a very expensive business.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not quite sure what's going to happen, but my own feeling with a specialty like mine is that it's going to, I mean, already what I can see what's happened, hearing aids provision is now disappearing out of the hospital to go to Specsavers.
Mm-hmm.
And things are going to be farmed out.
Yes.
And I can see a lot more work being done in the periphery. You know, why do you need an outpatient clinic in an expensive hospital when you could actually go out to the periphery and do it? You know, you could shut an outpatient clinic down.
Mm-hmm.
But then you've got to think, well, how many patients who see in the outpatients have got to come back for a CT or MRI scan? And then, you know, should you be doing... can a hospital afford, with all the expensive stuff that's now going on in medicine, to deal with all the so-called trivia in medicine, which are terribly important for the patient,
mm.
but not necessarily life-saving? You know, will it all be end up as a really first-class emergency service, which I think it will, personally.
Yes.
The
yes.
rest of it farmed out in some sort of privatisation bit.
Mm.
But the problem I see with that is it completely destroys cohesion within departments.
Mm.
You know, I think the endocrine department, if it started splitting up somehow, it would be a different place to what you remember, with a lot of joint meetings and
yes.
cups of tea and, well, they've got this patient, can we talk about it, and all that sort of business. And I think it's going to be difficult to teach doctors, and I think it's going to be difficult to teach them the sort of, I don't know, almost the ethics of medicine and the how to break bad news and all this sort of business,
mm-hmm.
if it's all tangled up with... Because we used to spend a lot of time talking to our registrars and SHOs, you know, they would come and say, look, you know, I don't know how to approach this. Patient's obviously got horrible cancer. What do we actually say?
Mm-hmm.
And it was very important to try and work out how you do approach these things. I don't think there's a time now.
But equally, they have counselling in this, or the students certainly do.
Yeah.
I mean, they get more solidly taught in a
yes.
formal way as against the apprentice
yeah.
way.
Yeah.
Sure, no, it's very tricky.
And I don't know which is best.
No, sure.
I have no idea. But I sort of look on my career as being terribly influenced by my bosses.
Yes.
Actually.
Yes.
And if they taught me rubbish, I'm probably still practicing rubbish, but I'm not quite sure.
So did Macbeth's wish for a university link ever come about? I mean,
not really, no.
There isn't one
no,
now?
No. Well, no, I mean, we're... No, there isn't.
No, sure. I didn't know one. And do you think that the NHS in Oxford, say, is short-changed at all financially because of the university?
I think so.
Yes,
I think so. I mean, if I was going to run a hospital, I would go to somewhere like Swindon. I wouldn't take on the most incredibly complex work that costs money.
Right.
I would do routine... I mean, we never quite understood why the old Radcliffe, when it was just left with neurosurgery, plastics, eyes and ENT, couldn't have made a fortune.
Yes.
Because there was no geriatrics blocking up the beds. There was no... there was a neurosurgical high dependency unit, I think that's what it was called,
right.
But there was nothing terribly expensive about the patients that were going through. And we always assumed that the finance of the Radcliffe was going into a black hole of the John Radcliffe. We never quite knew what happened to it. I know.
Absolutely.
Chris Adams got terribly worried when he wrote that paper called Ox Dons. Do you remember that?
No, I don't. Maybe not after my time.
I think he was seeing a huge number of Greek patients, and all the private practice that he was earning was going back into the hospital, he thought, to provide extra nurses and facilities. But when you looked at the accounts in the medical staff meetings, it was quite obvious that neurosurgery It was disappearing somewhere.
I can believe that. And did Chris get anywhere?
I don't know, but he's it'd be interesting to talk to. Are you going to be able to meet?
Right. Okay. Well, I'll certainly try. Because I'd like to interview him.
Because he would know. He would give you some very stern feelings, I think, about finance. Certainly, he used to get very fierce with these medical.
Yeah. Is there any condition that's, as it were, appeared or is more common in ENT because of increasing ageing?
Deafness, undoubtedly. Mm-hmm. And noise deafness used to be a major problem at the motorworks, but that's been around here.
Yes, right.
When it was Presteel.
Really? With the hammering, is it?
With all the banging and hammering, and then they, you know, a lot of measuring was done of the sound limits, and A, machines got quieter, but B, there's rigid enforcement on ear protection when you're doing these noisy works.
Right.
But I mean, I think there's no doubt everybody goes deaf if they live long enough. Like everybody needs a prostate surgeon as they get a bit older.
And what frequencies go in the networks? The low frequencies?
Unfortunately, it's all the high frequencies, which is the one where the consonant speech are, you know, the D's, the T's, the F's.
And the children, I mean, the high pitched voices of the young. Yeah. Yes.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And your wife. Anything you can't hear. But it makes it very difficult. It used to be called cocktail party deafness, because when there's a group of people all talking, it's very difficult to filter out what you're saying. And with the best and most expensive hearing aid, it still hasn't got sorted out.
And
so I think that's increased. And I think there's no doubt that, I mean, I don't know enough about cancer now, but actually I'm one of the Graham Cox, who you won't know, but he's just retiring, but he's coming to supper here a few nights. But he undoubtedly seen a huge change from the laryngeal cancers into the floor of mouth cancers.
Right.
And nobody's quite sure why this is happening, but it, you know, horrific surgery has to be done now to get rid of the jaw and all this sort of business. So cancers have changed.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many more women we've noticed with cancers of the head and neck, probably because women have not stopped smoking as much as men have stopped smoking.
Yeah.
So when
and they started later too.
They started when I was doing it. One always used to tell the students, "You've got 10 male laryngeal cancers to one woman," but I believe it's now 4 or 5 women to 6 men, something like that.
Right.
So that's changed. So I think cancer's changed, but I'm not quite sure. Apart from the male female, and the fact it's changed from the larynx to the jaw, and the French have got huge jaw problems from rough red wine. And smoking cigarettes that hang on their bottom lip, Gauloises, and without any filter tips.
Yes.
But that's where one of the biggest nations for this.
And the rough red wine does it.
Rough red wine, and well, that's what it's thought.
Right.
And the Indians get a lot of it from betel nut chewing,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and spitting out the betel nut, and also. It reverse cigarette smoking. I'm not quite sure how you do that, but you put the lighter down and suck away.
Well, they walk on coals, don't they? So they're used to that sort of thing.
That may be a bit wrong.
Right. Well, Andrew, that's terrific. Anything else you want to say?
No, it's fascinating to talk about these things. It's nice to remember all these
Absolutely.
People and things. And, you know, I never ever knew Eric Peake, but he was a chap that I would love to have met, because he and Gavin Livingston used to like each other tremendously. Mm. And of course, Gavin Livingston's nephews, one is Q Livingston from Montage.
Who is he? I didn't know he was a
nephew. Neil Livingston.
Yes, I know
he's
both.
Another nephew.
Yes.
They were a nephew of.
Right. And Alistair Livingston, does that mean anything to you?
Yeah.
He was my sort of age, well, they all are, but a different branch, but he was vaguely related.
Oh, was he? Yeah.
Yes. But he went to Australia, I mean, as a surgeon. He was a general surgeon.
Right, right.
But he was, an undergraduate here that I knew.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, very interesting.
And do you think the people coming in are as bright as they used to be?
They're much brighter.
Yes.
I could never get in. But they're also multi-talented. I mean, they've all got great aid at the piano and...
Yes.
And no, I originally started to think about doing forestry. That was because I had no idea when I left school. I was at a school where most people went in the army, and then when I left school, I had no idea what I wanted
was
to do.
Was that Wellington?
Yeah,
yeah.
And then I, and it was also just before A levels were graded,
Right.
So you were the school hero if you got an A level by 0.25%, because you hadn't wasted any time.
Yes.
So sport was very much encouraged.
Yeah.
And then we lived next door to a man who founded, a chap called Ken Rankin, he'd founded the only private forestry company in this country. And he went off to work every day in a Land Rover with a gun, a dog and a picnic camp. And I thought that was a very good job. So he advised me, well, if I wanted to do that, you better come, and you can come, but you must go to Oxford, where we had a full forestry school.
Yes, yes.
So he gave me this ticket and I went up, and I've forgotten the name of the professor of forestry. Anyway, he said, well, yeah, we could take you, but you better get into one of the colleges. Take this note round to St John's. Anyway, I didn't get in, or I didn't do it in the end, but I met Bob Torrance at St John's, who later became a patient. And
yes,
he vaguely remembers meeting me. I mean, he says he did, I probably didn't. But he said, Freeland, there's no way you could get into the university beside foresters and geographers, the lowest form of academic life. And anyway, the only reason you even considered is you could run quite quickly. Out. So I never did medicine at Oxford. Because my idea suddenly changed. If I get into St John's, maybe I could persuade them to take me to medicine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you always knew you wanted to do medicine as well.
No, I didn't. It came up when I met some medical students,
yes,
who told me to be very high up the Darwinian scale of evolution. You needed to be dependent on your parents a long time. Why not be a medic?
Yes.
And I thought, and they, of course, when I went to Guy's, most of Guy's was full of South Africans playing rugby who'd been there, just like Mary's was full of Welshmen who just got off the train at Paddington.
And National Service, did you?
I missed that.
Mm-hmm.
I missed that by 2 years.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, I think that finished in 59 or thereabouts.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah, sure.
So I left school in 61, I suppose it was.
Yeah. Okay, Andrew, really marvelous interview. Thank you very much indeed.
Talking to you.
Thank you very much.